Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We celebrate a birthday today. No, it's not the anniversary of the Research on Religion podcast, although we are coming up on our 100th episode in a couple months. Rather, the celebration is for the bicentennial of the Princeton Theological Seminary, founded in 1812 and still going strong today. Having recently been the guest of the Princeton Theological Seminary via an invitation from the Witherspoon Institute, which is not directly affiliated with the seminary, I thought I should pay my respect to this esteemed Presbyterian institution with a podcast about a portion of its history. More specifically, I thought it would be informative to spend some time today talking about one of Princeton's most noted thinkers of the 19th century, Charles Hodge. To cite the preface of the book written by today's guest, Andrew Hofacker, quote, "Charles Hodge is regarded by many as the most significant American theologian of the 19th century. He drove forward the rapid growth of theological education and contributed to Presbyterians' wide-ranging influence in public life. His advocacy of a reformed orthodoxy combined with evangelical piety attracted a broad following within old-school Presbyterianism that spilled over into American evangelicalism as a whole," unquote. As mentioned, that brief description of Reverend Hodge was written by Andrew Hofacker, an emeritus professor of church history at the Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Dr. Hofacker has served as a captain in the U.S. Army, was a professor of theology at Grove City College for 25 years, and is author of two monographs, Piety and the Princeton Theologians, and, most recently, Charles Hodge, The Pride of Princeton, which, by the way, has a foreword written by Mark Knoll, which is a big deal. Andy, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's good to be here.
Okay, I'm going to have to start out by admitting my ignorance and letting both you and the world know that until I saw your book, I had no idea who Charles Hodge was. I had always thought that the Pride of Princeton was either Bill Bradley or Brooke Shields. So, I do know Samuel Davies. He was the first president of Princeton, which was the College of New Jersey at that time. So my question is, how could I have been so blind to not know of Charles Hodge?
Well, it's not unusual that people do not remember Hodge. Even within Presbyterianism itself, Hodge had become a kind of forgotten person of the 19th century. And only one biography was written of him prior to this year, one by his son, written soon after his death. But there has been somewhat of a revival of interest in Princeton, or old Princeton as a whole, and of Charles Hodge within the last couple of decades among scholars of Presbyterianism.
Now, I have a question. You mentioned Princeton, because we're talking about Princeton Theological Seminary. Is that different than Princeton University? What's the history there?
Yeah, Princeton University was founded earlier than the seminary. It was the outgrowth of what was called the Log College, founded in 1726, a very small founding in which pastors were trained by William Tennant, but the seminary was founded in 1812. It was the College of New Jersey. It was the Princeton University was originally the College of New Jersey. It was changed to Princeton in 1896, but the seminary was founded in 1812.
Okay. And are they still separate entities today? Because when I was out there last spring, I remember there seemed to be some difference in the billing and how you got around campus and stuff.
Oh, yes. They're very different institutions. They've been separate since 1812.
Okay. Now, the other thing, too, is I just recently visited Princeton. I didn't notice any statues or paintings or buildings named for Charles Hodge, but it must have been because I wasn't looking. Is he still a pretty celebrated figure at Princeton Theological Seminary?
Well, Hodge Hall is one of the dormitories.
Oh, well, that's probably where I stayed. I just wasn't thinking about it.
Well, there are several dormitories on campus. Mm-hmm. There's also Alexander Hall, which mm-hmm. is named for Hodge's mentor and the inaugural professor at the seminary. And the chapel, Miller Chapel, is named after Samuel Miller. And these were the three seminal figures at Princeton Theological Seminary.
Well, this just reminds me next time I stay anywhere, I have to look into the history of the name a little bit. So I think I was at Hodge Hall. We stayed in a dormitory, and I for a couple nights I got to see what it was like to be a seminary student. And
yes.
you know, there was no flat-screen TVs to watch basketball, and then so that was pretty hard. So here's my question for you, because Charles Hodge, as you mentioned, is a relatively forgotten character in the religious history of the United States, and the only biography that was written by him was by his son, and that was over 100 years ago. What generated your interest in studying Charles Hodge and old school Princeton Theological Seminary in general, relating back to your old book? And if I'm correct, you received your degree from Brown University, which is an Ivy rival of Princeton, is it not?
Yes, and when I was there, there was a great rivalry, primarily in hockey. My interest was stimulated in my PhD program. Everybody has to come up with a thesis. And I read an interesting article and then a book by Ernest Sandin. And the book was entitled The Origins of Fundamentalism. It was published in 1967. And in this book, this was the first time that fundamentalism was taken seriously as a theological movement. Before that, fundamentalism was considered primarily a sociological phenomenon. But Sandin pointed out that fundamentalism originated by a strange union between dispensational millennials and old Princeton thinkers, because they had a common interest in fighting the rising tide of liberalism. And so there was their emphasis on the Bible and its authority. So I read this book by Sandin, and Sandin made some claims that I knew were not true, and that is that Princeton theology was primarily a wooden, rationalistic enterprise, and I knew that there was another side to the theological education at Princeton. It wasn't simply theologically and therefore focusing on belief, but there was also an emotive side. There was a subjective element to Christianity. And so therefore, my thesis on Princeton, which was published eventually as Piety and the Princeton Theologians, was that Princeton had a strong emphasis on the devotional life, the subjective aspects of religion, and not simply the intellectual or cognitive. And so therefore it was one of the easiest theses to be written, actually. And it kind of sparked the revival of interest in old Princeton and Hodge in particular.
That's a very good point, because when you talk about fundamentalism, I know the history of fundamentalism, and I would just say, yeah, it was the millennium dispensationalist at the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s. I would not have ever traced it back to Princeton, nor would I have ever thought of Princeton as being, you know, much more than just the intellectual side of theology, that it had that, as you say, emotive or very deeply spiritual side to it. So this is going to be a learning experience for me. So let's dig into it and talk about the good Reverend Charles Hodge. Now, he lived quite a long life for a man of that era. He was born in 1797, passing away in 1878. So that's a good 81 years or so. Let's start at the beginning and tell us about his early upbringing.
Charles Hodge was left without a father at a very young age. So he was raised by his mother in a very strict Presbyterian home. He kind of joked that he was drilled in the Westminster Catechism by his mother, assisted by the pastor, Ashbel Green, who eventually became the president of Princeton University. And so therefore his early religious life was very nurturing, drilled in the catechism, but also very pious in terms of his religious life. He he said that he swore but once in his life when he was a child. That's an unusual claim for any age.
Mm-hmm.
And he therefore had this, from the very beginning, a balance between theological belief, the Westminster Catechism, Westminster Confession of Faith, and also this very warm, what we would call evangelical piety.
And so I would assume that this is what drove him to a theological calling. I mean, there's many people who were raised in strict Presbyterian homes that, you know, went on to become other things like carpenters or lawyers. So is that what drove him to the seminary?
Yes, he was schooled in Princeton. His mother moved the family there in 1812, which was the same year that Princeton Seminary was founded, and he remembered sitting in the balcony listening to Archibald Alexander give his inaugural address. And so therefore, from the very first of moving to Princeton in 1812, he was familiar with the seminary, and thus he went on to go to the College of New Jersey. And in the midst of his study there, the question became, what was he to do? And he considered at first perhaps a career in medicine, but a revival came to Princeton in 1814, and Charles Hodge was one of those converted in this revival. And so you see that his life was nurtured, brought up in the church, but there came a time in which he made a profession of faith. And so therefore, revivalism, or the conversion experience, was a culmination of his having been nurtured in the church. And that, of course, was to change when the Second Great Awakening came, that your conversion, dramatic conversion, comes first, and then you're nurtured after that. So there's kind of two models of the Christian life at work here. And so Hodge illustrated the notion of being brought up in a Christian home. You're the subject of a church life. You hear preaching, you celebrate the sacraments, you're a member of the church because you're baptized into the church, and then you experience a conversion experience as a culmination of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led to his considering a calling to go into the ministry.
Now, when he said a revival came to Princeton in 1814, are you speaking in more metaphorical terms, or was there actually a revival that rolls into town with the wagons and sets up the tents? Because this is near the end of the Second Great Awakening, which is the first decade or so of the 1800s. So is that what he's experiencing, that kind of George Whitefield, somebody speaking on a stump and to large crowds type of revival?
Well, it's not exactly that. There are kind of two kinds of revivalism. Even as a part of the First Great Awakening, there was the strong emotional, and there was in the Second Great Awakening the kind of frontier stump revival. But at Princeton, it was more subdued than that. But it was a significant event. A large number of the senior class at Princeton were converted, and Charles was among them. And in fact, people made the kind of joke that Charles has been enlisted in Christ's army because of his conversion. So it was a significant experience, and it was one that that did not dramatically change Hodge's life, because he'd again been nurtured and knew the catechism and was a church goer, but he dated his conversion at that time.
I will vouch for the fact that Princeton is more subdued, because when I was there last spring, I rolled into town with my cowboy hat, boots on, and somebody at the Witherspoon Institute pulled me over and said, "We're much more subdued than that." And I said, "Oh, okay, well." But speaking of this intersection that Charles Hodge represents of, you know, raised in piety, but then having that conversion experience, this is a really interesting time in American religious life history. So before we continue on with it, Charles Hodge's life, I think it would be worthwhile to set the context, set the table, so to speak, of what's going on, and examine Presbyterianism at this time. In fact, we could even possibly go back further before his birthday and talk about the divisions between the old light or the old school and the new light or new school division in the mid-18th century. So what was the nature of Presbyterianism at this time? What was the growing division here in the early 18th century, and where did Hodge fall into all of this?
Presbyterianism in America is the result of two parties kind of coming together, in which there is somewhat of a tension. There is the New England Puritan strand of Presbyterianism, and there is the Scotch-Irish brand of Presbyterianism. And the tension between the two was that the New England Puritan side tended to be very positive towards the First Great Awakening, the Whitfields, the Edwards, revivalism that was dominant in the First Great Awakening, the 18th century. And then the other side of Presbyterianism was the Scotch-Irish, which, while both would have been adherents to the Westminster Confession, the Scotch-Irish were much more devoted to the theological development of the church, interested in the sacraments, interested in maintaining good order. So you have the kind of ardor of the New England Puritan and the order of the Scotch-Irish Presbyterianism. So that developed into, eventually, with the First Great Awakening, there was a split in the church. In 1741, the new side Presbyterians were very much in favor of revivals, and if you were going to be called to the ministry, you had to give evidence of strong piety. And the old side, which tended to be more restrained with regard to revivals, and so that was there was a split in the church from 1741 to 1758. They eventually came back together, but Presbyterianism has, from its beginning, had this kind of internal tension between these two groups.
It's a tension that still plays out today, I would assume, correct?
That's correct, yes. I would say that wherever you find evangelicalism as a whole, you're going to have those who are more focused on theological precision, the objective nature of Christian doctrine, and those who are more drawn toward the piety and devotion. I would say that the balanced Christian life will entail both of those.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a definitional question here, because you used a term a couple times that, not being a Presbyterian, I'm not all that familiar with, and I think a number of our readers might not be, and that's the Westminster Confession. What does that imply for Presbyterianism?
The Westminster Confession was a document produced by the Puritans in England in the 17th century, when the church was, when Presbyterianism was kind of born in England. There was the question of should the original 39 articles of the Church of England, should that be remain the confession? And when there was a dramatic change in the religious situation in England, there was a meeting of pastors and theologians at Westminster Cathedral, and they decided that rather than simply trying to revise the 39 articles, which were basically reformed in terms of orientation, that is, Calvinistic,
mm-hmm.
they wanted to have a fuller statement of faith. And the result of that was the Westminster Confession in 1628.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Calvinism part. And we just talked about the new side and old side. Is there any claim by either side that one is more Calvinistic than the other?
Well, certainly the old school Presbyterians, which Hodge represented in the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
claimed that the genuine form of American Presbyterianism was a strongly Calvinistic, and the New School Presbyterianism said that they wanted to be Calvinistic, but they wanted to adapt the Calvinism to be more compatible with the kind of revivalism that was characteristic of the Second Great Awakening. And so therefore, there were several movements within American religion as a whole, which tended to be, with its original roots, American theology was rooted in Calvinism. They moved towards an Arminian perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, the kind of tension between Calvinism and Arminianism, if you were to characterize the first Great Awakening, Whitfield, Edwards, and others, if you looked at their preaching, they saw revivals as the work of God, and God brings about revivals because he is sovereign, and he calls by preaching people out of their sin, and so therefore there was a strong Calvinistic orientation. In the second Great Awakening, revivalism is not so much the work of God as it is the work of men who can use various measures to bring about revival because men have free will. And so you have this kind of tension between revivalism of the first Great Awakening, Calvinistic, God is sovereign, he pours out revivals in certain areas and other areas he doesn't, whereas in the second Great Awakening, it's man's task to bring about revivals. And there are certain measures that you can use to ensure that revivals will come about.
So this is the context that Charles Hodge is sitting in the second decade of the 19th century. So 1814, he has his conversion, he has his revivalistic moment. And this is at the time where he is considering his theological calling. So take us from that point to where he becomes a professor at Princeton. What's going on for the next several years?
Well, he graduated in 1820. He was asked by his mentor, Archibald Alexander, to become a professor at the seminary. Alexander's relationship with Hodge was always very close. In fact, he was essentially Hodge's father that he never had because his father died so young. And so Hodge was the graduated second in his class from the seminary, and therefore when Alexander asked him to become a professor, he was more than happy to oblige. He struggled somewhat with that call, but he had been doing some preaching. He had been ordained, and he saw that his calling was more towards teaching and training future ministers rather than going into the pastorate itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, when he starts out as a professor at Princeton, and he took a pretty quick ride to become a professor there. It takes a little bit longer to do that here in present day, but he really was active intellectually. In fact, he created something known as the Princeton Review. Is that correct?
That's correct. He formed this in 1825.
Now, that's not the Princeton Review everybody checks to find out which college to go to, right?
That's right.
Okay, yeah, because I heard, oh, he's the founder of the Princeton Review. They're already reviewing people back then. Tell us a little bit about what he did with that Princeton Review and what were some of the things that he wrote about, or more specifically, what he didn't write about, because he seemed to write about everything.
Well, this was the era that began a very strong religious journalism. When he formed the Princeton Review in 1825, he formed it as a means of reprinting articles that may have escaped people's notice, and so therefore it did not consist of original articles. As it developed, it became probably the foremost religious journal of its day, but there were many other religious journals that were being published then. And these are journals that have articles of 30 to 40 to 50 pages long, no pictures, no cartoons, but they took everything seriously, and they examined everything, not just theological ideas, biblical ideas, but they also dealt with matters of literature and science, culture as a whole, and so therefore one could say that the Princeton Review became a Princeton Looks at the World journal. And there's nothing that escaped Hodge's notice. In fact, he was editor for so long, he called it his ball and chain. He worked with a couple of others to choose the articles and the people who wrote them. But it was a very prominent theological journal that well through the middle of the 19th century. It was when the Princeton Review came out, people read it, not just pastors, but they were very well informed about the religious life, very well informed about education, the developments in science, and literature, and culture as a whole.
And so not only did they reproduce articles, but Hodge himself actually consistently wrote his own thought pieces in that journal, correct?
Yeah, he wrote some 5,000 pages.
Wow.
Over the course of his time. So when you take Hodge's body of work as a whole, his Systematic Theology, three hefty volumes, his commentary on Romans, Corinthians, Ephesians, his correspondence in the Princeton library is 13 linear feet long.
Wow.
And he wrote to everybody. So Hodge was a key figure.
And then it seems to be the major transmission belt for a lot of his ideas into the public arena, too, I would guess.
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, one of the big points in your biography of Hodge is his trip to Germany in 1827. It lasts about 2 years. This is a really interesting point in time for Hodge as well, and it represents another point of intersection of very different intellectual streams coming together at the time, because in Germany, this is the time of G.W.F. Hegel and the rise of social science. You're getting new universities created. Theology at this time is being relegated to the academic sideline. So for somebody of Hodge's thinking, a very pious individual, he has the revivalism side of him, the very intellectual side of him as well. This must have been a pretty rough trip for Hodge, given his adherence to biblical literalism and his strong piety, or was it? How did he get to Germany, and what happens there?
Well, he became aware in his young professorate that he needed to be aware of the wider developments in theology and biblical criticism that were taking place in Germany, because Germany was kind of a generation ahead of America. And so he didn't know German, so he couldn't read the German journals. He knew some French, but he began to see that if he was to be proficient in his field, he needed more education. And so he wanted to take this two-year hiatus in order to strengthen his background. He wanted to become aware of the wider theological scene that was developing in Europe. He knew broadly that new developments were taking place in biblical criticism. New developments were taking place in terms of theological systems. And so, since he wanted Princeton to be on the top of its game, he realized that he had to go and learn firsthand. So he studied first in France, and in Arabic and some of the other languages that are associated with the ancient period. And then he spent, the key time was his time in Berlin, where he became aware of the theological scene there.
And what is that scene? What is happening there? Now, I know I mentioned Hegel, and I remember taking a class as an undergraduate specifically in Hegel, and for some reason I pulled an A from the class, but I did not understand a thing that Hegel said.
You wouldn't be alone in that.
Okay, good. But I know Hegel is a figure that's really transforming things, but there's a lot of other theologians that at times are transforming things, and again, not necessarily in a way of more piety. So what is the scene in Germany?
Well, the key figure there is a figure that many Americans would not recognize the name, and that is Friedrich Schleiermacher. He's the founder of Protestant liberalism. He was also a founder of the University of Berlin, which was founded in 1810, founded as an Enlightenment institution. And the key thing was that at Berlin, all subjects were to be studied with the idea that there are no final truths, that we are constantly in search of the truth, and therefore everything was to be developed scientifically, on a scientific model, that things were, you don't begin with revelation, you don't begin with theological truths. And so therefore, Schleiermacher had to fight to have theology even being included in the curriculum there. And he had to convince others that theology deserved to be there, but it had to conform to this model of Enlightenment development. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the very nature of theology was being changed, in which theology is not a final system, but theology is something that is constantly evolving, constantly developing on the model of the Enlightenment. And so Hodge saw that firsthand, because he was there. It was just founded in 1810. He's there in the middle 1820s, and he began to see that the model for theological education was going to change from the Princeton model, in which piety and intellect are so closely aligned, in which now a pastor was not to be following a calling to preach the gospel, to elucidate the scriptures, but the pastor was to be a professional. And a professional is one who is constantly developing one's theology, but also being trained primarily for a sociological role as opposed to a pastoral theological role.
I want to take a sidestep out of history right now and examine that, because one of the things that I've always been fascinated with is looking at the role that seminaries play within denominations.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be this tension that as a denomination grows, they want to create, as you say, a professional clergy, one that is not just a calling, but is a profession. And that is really centered around seminary life, especially some of the elite seminaries. But again, you see this Berlin school thinking seeping in, is that, well, there are no final truths. We really need to intellectualize this. And on top of it, number of these seminaries are associated with major research universities that are doing things like biology and physics. And mm-hmm. you want to be part of the academic group that fits in with this crowd. And, you know, the physicist and the biologist and even the anthropologist are not too big on the revivalism of the old piety or old Princeton school thinking. And it just seems that strand of theological education can really suck a lot of the energy out of a denomination, especially when you're thinking about the training of the pastorate that is then to go out to the general public and to get people to fill the pews. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Hodge saw, and I agree with him, he saw the pastorate as a calling to preach the gospel, to teach the scriptures, to encourage a good theological view, as well as this piety. And he saw that if the pastorate becomes a profession, and one of the books written in the 1990s focused on the fact that when a pastor is called today, there can be as many jobs on his job description as 14 different things. He is to preach, he is to counsel, he's to be a church administrator, he's to be a facilitator in youth work, he is to be a community leader as well. That if you have all these calling, if you have all these different things that are to be done, then the original role of the pastor has been lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so he saw this, but he also saw that if a pastor is to be a good pastor, he must have a rigorous theological training. So he agreed with the rigor of theological training, but he also argued that Princeton, if it were to continue according to its original model, must retain the other aspect as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore he wanted Princeton Seminary to be every bit as rigorous in its theological training and to learn the elements of biblical criticism, to become aware of the various developments we're taking in Germany and would eventually, of course, overtake in America. But he wanted to make sure that Princeton was rigorous, that people knew Greek and Hebrew, could expound the scriptures, but they would also retain this element of piety and devotion, and that would be what set Princeton apart. It would be orthodox, it would be pious, the ministers would be well-trained and know what liberals were thinking, but nevertheless retain the original calling of Presbyterianism.
You know, one of the sentences in your book that struck me the most and really summarized Hodge's life. You say on page 105 and 106, you said that the big challenge for Hodge was crafting a balance between maintaining a high level of intellectual rigor and a corresponding stress on piety. And that's a fairly difficult balance to achieve, I think.
Well, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And so therefore, what you had at Princeton was the rigor of the classroom, theological classroom, the instruction, the curriculum, which was very carefully arranged. But every Sunday afternoon, they had what was called conferences. It was held in the oratory. And there, the emphasis was on matters of experience. And so therefore, very pastoral in orientation. How does the pastor maintain this integrity of the intellect, as well as the integrity of the emotions, the emotive side, the subjective side? And so therefore, Princeton tried to balance the rigor of the classroom, which could become over-intellectualized, mm-hmm. as you have noted, but to maintain these Sunday afternoon conferences. They, of course, also had daily chapel, and so therefore there was an attempt to maintain this balance. And I think that that's always a precarious thing. And throughout my ministry as a church historian, I've tried to maintain in my classroom that, as I've been training pastors, there has to be this attempt at a balance between these two.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and this is just speculation off the top of my head, you are now at Reformed Theological Seminary down in Mississippi, and that's not associated with any particular major research university. It's a self-enclosed theological seminary, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so in that regard, it must be a little bit easier to maintain that balance, whereas at a place like Princeton or the University of Chicago or Harvard, Yale, there's this tug by the seminary schools that are affiliated or associated with them to tug those professors more in the intellectual rigor direction and completely forget about the more pious or the passionate side of religion.
Well, yes, but you also have the changes that take place in the late 19th century that build up to the fundamentalist liberal controversy.
Right.
You have the change in theological systems. In which the older confessions give way to new development, new theological views. So you have the change not only in which perhaps the emotive side tends to be neglected, but you also have a change in theological perspective in which, for instance, when Princeton was reorganized in 1929, it was reorganized in such a way that the old plan of the seminary was to be set aside, as it were, in which this balance between the two were to be found, and a broader interpretation of theology was to be accepted, so that the old Calvinism gives way to new perspectives on the scriptures, the person and work of Christ, in which there's a more inclusive theology being accepted. So you have a couple of things at work there.
I want to save that for another podcast, because that's a whole other interesting split and twist in Princeton Theological Seminary. Let's bring it back to Hodge. And again, we're talking about these different tensions, these different intersections that Hodge has to maintain. And he faces another one in the middle part of his career, 1837. There's another split in Presbyterianism. And again, it reflects what had happened roughly a century prior to that. But again, what is going on? What is the churning that is going on within Presbyterianism at this time? And how does Hodge fit into this 1837 schism?
Yeah, the 1837 split was the result of a growing divide between what became known as the New School, Old School. Divide. In the 18th century, you have the new side, or new light, and the old side, the old light schism. And now you have a growing divide over a lot of issues, frankly. There was the theological issues, that the new school tended to adapt Calvinism to the cultural scene in America, in which old Calvinism was viewed as hindering revivalism, hindering the kind of revivalism of Charles Finney in New York. You have a division over voluntary societies. The voluntary societies were the 19th century's version of parachurch ministries that we have today. So that you have societies for the distribution of biblical literature and Bibles. You have the formation of groups that were against alcohol. You have the temperance movement. You have the development of abolitionist groups. So all of these various voluntary societies, produced a division. The new school were very much in favor of these voluntary societies. The old school had a more limited view of the voluntary societies, and there was the question of slavery. The new school tended to be much more slanted towards the abolition of the immediate abolition, and the old school a more gradualist approach. So there were a number of issues that came up not only within Presbyterianism, but in other denominations as well, that eventually resulted in a split in 1837.
Now, where does Hodge sit on all this? Now, you mentioned two big issues here. One is just the organizational, theological aspects of Presbyterianism per se, but then there's the abolition movement, the issue of slavery, which had been an issue since the drafting of the Constitution and is really starting to heat up now, and we're quickly coming upon the Civil War. So where does Hodge sit on these different conflicts and intersections in society? Let's start first with Presbyterianism. Where did he fall on the old school, new school divide?
He was an old schooler, but he was not a radical old schooler. The radical old schoolers were known as the ultras, and they took they were the ones that really precipitated the schism that occurred in 1837. He was much more of in between the new schoolers and the ultra-old schoolers. And so, therefore, he became identified with once the split occurred, he remained with the old school. But he was frankly, against some of the measures that were taken at the General Assembly where the schism actually occurred. He would have preferred that the denomination work out some of these problems, but the ultras, they excised presbyteries who were new school in orientation and that were the result of the union with the Congregationalists at the in the Plan of Union in 1801. So Hodge was in favor of separating the Congregationalists from the denomination. But he was not in favor of some of the radical measures that were taken.
What were some more of the radical measures that were offered?
Yeah, the radical measure was actually to cut off these churches and presbyteries. He would have preferred that the presbyteries would remain but would stay within the Presbyterian form of government as opposed to the congregational form of government, because the Plan of Union was formed in 1801 so that the Calvinists on the upper frontier, because the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians were both Calvinists, why not work together? But the problem was that the form of government that was taking place in the churches would be congregational in some churches and Presbyterian in others, and Hodge says, let's just be Presbyterians.
Yeah.
And so he was in favor of getting rid of the congregational element.
Because they're just logistically incompatible with one another. Mm-hmm. Now, in the 1837 General Assembly, mm-hmm. as I understand, it takes place in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and Hodge did not attend that.
That's correct.
But what goes on? Because my thought was that the new schoolers picked up and left, and then they set up, I guess, a shadow assembly a few blocks down. Was it that they picked up and left, or were they pushed out? Because the story you were just telling seems to me that some of the ultra-old schoolers were really pushing them out.
Yeah, it was an excision that took place, and it wasn't that the new schoolers just up and left, but the delegates from the new school were not recognized at the assembly. This was all prearranged. They had several pre-assembly meetings, and this was arranged, and that's why Hodge was opposed to the manner in which this was carried out.
Now, just like the schism that occurred in the previous century, that lasted for a while, but then Presbyterians all got together and made up. Did that happen with this schism, or has this been a schism that has been ever present?
Now, the schism came back together again. In 1869, but of course that was after there was another split in the church as a result of the Civil War, so that you ended up with four Presbyterian denominations: New School North, New School South, Old School North, and Old School South. So you had four, and so the Presbyterians in the South, Old and New School, came together after the Civil War. The New School and Old School North did not come together until 1869.
Mm-hmm.
In 1983. So there remained a division.
It's just absolutely fascinating reading this history and thinking about the parallel of what's going on in the country in terms of slavery and states' rights and the Civil War during this period of time, because you just see the whole nation just being ripped asunder in so many different ways. It's not just the Civil War, but the whole fabric of American society is really going through a very violent churning, or a very difficult churning during this period of time. And which is one of the wonderful things about reading history, is that you see themes repeated time and time again, but also the parallels that we often don't think about. Let me go ahead and talk about the Civil War now, because as you mentioned, you had the theological divisions, or the governance divisions within Presbyterianism, but also there's this conflict over slavery, immediate abolition, gradual abolition, no abolition, and the issue of whether or not to go to war. How does Hodge play out in this?
Hodge clearly had a difficult time with all of this. He was absolutely devastated that not only would the church be divided, but his country was divided. And he wrote essays on this, in which he labored over this terrible event that rent the church and the country. And so he was very much conflicted about all this. With regard to slavery, he was again a moderate. The Old School South said that the job of the church is simply spiritual and should not become involved with the elimination of slavery. That's a matter for the government to handle. For Hodge, in fact, the leaders of the Southern Church would not have eliminated slavery, because they saw it as a way of ordering the society, white and black. But for Hodge, he saw slavery as a lower form of civilization, gradually to be eliminated. So he was a gradualist. So he found himself between the rabid abolitionists in the North, wanted to immediately eliminate slavery, and those who wanted to continue slavery. And he was clearly conflicted over this.
In terms, he tended to be a fairly strong nationalist too. So when he did have to, you know, push the button and make the choice, he sided with the Union.
That's correct. But he was very much opposed to the Gardner Spring Resolution at the General Assembly in 1860, which said that as to be a part of the Presbyterian Church, one had to profess the federal government. And Hodge says the General Assembly had no business making that a constitutional issue. And so therefore, while a strong nationalist, he was against the church making a stand that the Presbyterian Church supported the Presbyterian, the federal government. So while Hodge personally certainly supported the idea of union, he said it was not the church's business to make that a matter of the church's profession.
Yeah. Interesting stand on church-state relations there, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he is reflecting all these different tensions that are arising in society, and he seems to be a point that's trying to blend them or moderate them, and in many different ways. It seems to be his life.
And it's interesting that until the recent study of Hodge, he was so cast as a kind of a rigid old schooler that these moderate positions tended to be lost. And that's what makes Hodge such a fascinating character. He was clearly caught between factions, and he constantly was irenic in his approach to things that tended to be divisive.
Let's talk just briefly about a few of his other positions, some of them sure. which were a surprise to me. He took a position on Catholic baptism, which was somewhat surprising.
Not only with regard to Catholic baptism, but to whether the Roman Catholic Church is a visible church.
Mm-hmm.
He argued that the General Assembly had voted that Catholic baptism was not to be recognized, and therefore, if a person converted from Catholicism to Presbyterianism, they would have to be rebaptized. And Hodge says, let's go back to the original reformers. Calvin and Luther didn't, in the midst of their Reformation, they weren't rebaptized, and they didn't require that people be rebaptized. That baptism is baptism. If it's done in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, if it is done by a duly constituted pastor or priest, therefore it is a valid baptism. So Hodge took a stand against this. He also argued that the Roman Catholic Church may be a church that has lost its moorings, but it is still a visible church. He likened it to Old Testament Israel, which, though it had in portions of its history become apostate, it was still the covenant people of God. And he said the Roman Catholic Church is like that. It's lost its moorings, but it is still a part of the visible church.
And again, reflecting a lot of the streams that are occurring in American history at this point in time, because you're getting Irish immigration. I know my parents came, or my relatives came over around that period of time, and there was a lot of anti-Catholicism in the North with these new arrivals. And so he's, you know, again, staking a pretty controversial ground, and which was kind of interesting. There's another controversy that you talk about, too, that he gets involved in, something known as the Merseburg controversy. What is that?
Merseburg theology was a theology of a small denomination that was Presbyterian in orientation. The main leaders here were Philip Schaff and John Williamson Nevin, and there were controversies that focused primarily on the nature of the church, the nature of the church as a visible institution. Schaff and Nevin claimed that American Presbyterianism had become too sectarian and too much focused on the individual as opposed to the body of Christ. And this worked out. The real tension became over the nature of the sacraments, specifically the Lord's Supper. And Nevin had written a book. And by the way, Nevin had originally taught Hodge's courses while Hodge was in Germany, so they began as a very close relationship. But Nevin wrote a book called The Mystical Presence, in which he claimed that American Presbyterianism had lost the mystical notion of the Lord's Supper. And there is a huge amount of writing back and forth between Nevin and Hodge, very, very antagonistic over the nature of the Lord's Supper. Hodge tended to interpret the Lord's Supper as primarily a memorial service, whereas Nevin said that there is the notion of union with Christ, which takes place in the Lord's Supper, and this mystical element. Hodge did not hold that, and at their differences were what was Calvin, and frankly, Calvin was more oriented toward the Nevin's position than it was toward the Hodge. So that's a very interesting controversy.
Yeah. And one other one I want to discuss, too, because this is also reflecting a new stream of thought making its way into 19th century American dialogue and education at the time, is Darwinism. What was Hodge's position on Charles Darwin?
Well, Hodge wrote a very significant work, Darwinism, of course, broke onto the scene in 1859, and Hodge did not immediately respond to it, but eventually he taught on it in his theological classes, and then eventually he wrote a book entitled What is Darwinism? And he focused primarily on definition, and he pointed out that the heart of Darwinism was that the evolution that took place was unguided. It was a matter of natural selection, and so that the species that evolved were simply the result of random development, that eventually the species developed because of this random mutations. And Hodge says that at that very basic level, without a teleological perspective, the notion that evolution was purposeful, mm-hmm. moving toward a goal, that it is, in its very basic nature, atheistic. He said that he did not charge Darwin with being an atheist, but he said his system, as a system, was atheistic because it lacked the sense of purpose and what he called a teleology.
Mm-hmm. It seems that he's, you know, at the forefront of this controversy, is really kind of sensing of where Darwinism would be going in the future, and so pretty prescient.
And it's still recognized today. This book is recognized even today in the controversies that take place between Darwinism and anti-Darwinism, that Hodge's book is still acknowledged as being a key book that gets at a key element.
So he was pretty prescient in terms of recognizing where that controversy was going to be going. So it seems that, and we've talked, the Darwin controversy is coming at the end of what I would, from what I pick up on your book, is really the intellectual ferment and the middle part of Hodge's career, which lasts through about the 1830s through the 1860s. But he still has another decade or two to go in his life. So tell us a little bit about the post-Civil War Charles Hodge. Where is he going intellectually, professionally at this point in time, up to his death in 87?
Well, he began to realize that his theological classes, he really needed to put his work down into written form. And so he worked on his systematic theology, which was a massive three-volume work. And I think the most significant developments there was that, again, following up on his interest in Darwinism, Hodge always had a very strong interest in science. When he was in Germany, for example, he attended all kinds of lectures by a man by the name of Humboldt on in the areas of science. And so he constantly was aware of the developments that were taking place, obviously with the coming of Darwinism. And I would say that another things that he was very prescient on was the role that science was going to continue to take in the future. And especially with the rise of the social sciences and the rise of sociology founded by Auguste Comte. And he treats Comte in his systematic theology, and he said that once science tends to overstep its bounds, that is, when it says that the scientific method alone can give truth, once you have science applied to fields that are not essentially scientific in nature, specifically psychology and sociology, you're dealing with the human element, that while science can study human behavior, that once you begin to exclude elements like the religious element, which Auguste Comte did, you exclude a part of an essential part of our nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore he saw the development of what became pseudosciences, sciences that the application of science to areas that are not appropriate to the scientific method. And so he really helped people to see that he never was against science, very much in favor of science within its realm. In fact, the whole notion of a warfare between science and religion was totally foreign to Hodge.
Mm-hmm.
He says that science and religion are compatible, and they ought to be complementary.
That is, you know, a great point to be making, because it is one of the themes that we wrestle with here implicitly on our Research on Religion podcast. We are specifically oriented toward social scientific examinations of religion, and we are very careful to mention that that involves the human element, that of how people set up churches and how people worship and do things in the human realm. But we also are on this podcast trying to give our due respect to that faith, to the faithful component, the understanding that there are many different ways of understanding the world. And as Hodge really represents this well, again, he's one of these people who takes these competing streams of thought, competing tensions, and tries to resolve them. And I guess with the time that we have remaining, if you could look back on Hodge's legacy, and I should note that a few minutes ago I said that he died in 87. It was actually 1878. So we're roughly about 130, 135 years away from his death. And what legacy do you see Charles Hodge as playing in different realms? One, in Presbyterianism, two, in Princeton Theological Seminary, and three, in American theological or social life in general?
Well, Hodge was clearly a central figure of his day, and that needs to be recovered. And therefore, what did he leave behind? Well, he left behind a legacy that contemporary evangelicalism owes a lot to Hodge, because he retained the orthodox faith that evangelicals want to value very much, and so therefore the very heart of evangelicalism, historically speaking, is rooted in this time period, and Hodge was in addition to being a very faithful Presbyterian, he was commissioned, for example, by the Sunday School Union to write The Way of Life, which became a kind of best-selling layman's guide to theology in the 19th century. So he provided the heart of evangelical legacy, theologically speaking, experientially speaking. Hodge modeled the kind of evangelical commitment that I think evangelicalism in its best form today wants to retain. In terms of Princeton Seminary, he gave Princeton, he kind of put Princeton on the map, and he was just well known. Princeton Theological Seminary, as I mentioned before, you say might be covered in another venue. Princeton Seminary changed in 1929, and so therefore this kind of remembering back of Hodge and his position, given Princeton's mainline denominational emphasis today, is there is a certain tension at work there, and there's much more of a broad perspective that is taught being a mainline seminary, that Hodge was might be considered by some at Princeton as being much too narrow theologically, Calvinistic, that there's a broader perspective. So I think that it's good for the seminary, when it celebrates its bicentennial this year, to remember that the halls that are the chapel that is named after these original people, it's good to see that in perspective today. And then in culturally speaking, I would say that Hodge had this breadth of perspective that when we think about theologians today, we tend to think that they're in kind of in an ivory tower situation, and they're not really related to life. Well, Hodge reflected on that, and Hodge was much more attentive, and used the journal, the Princeton Review, greatly to advantage to speak to American culture as a whole. So I think in those three areas, Hodge deserves to be remembered today.
And I think that is a really great point. And the book that you wrote on him, his biography, Charles Hodge, The Pride of Princeton, is available, and we'll put a link to it up on our website. And we want to thank you for really helping to recover his history, because it was a fascinating read for me, just to not only understand Charles Hodge, but to understand U.S. history and religious history with a much better than I had previously done before. So, Andy, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, Tony, you've been a very gracious host, and it's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.